Andy, Fred, good afternoon. Flying transition, absolutely perfect. Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
It's very good to have you back. Last time we talked to our friend, the Colonel, and this time around, we obviously are at a different stage. Many things which we then discussed in terms of strategies have come to bear. Other things have also culminated, and we've just seen that we're still trying to find artillery ammunition at decent prices and decent amounts and then decent rounds to be brought to bear in Ukraine. So from a strategic perspective, you've always looked to also at things from a very high level and break it down into simple tasks. Where do you think the US stands with regard to muddling through and coming to a conclusion that it should support Ukraine?
Well, looking at it from the U.S. side, there are a few things that have sort of upset me over the past 2 years. And one is, and I want to be as politically nonpartisan as possible and not view this through a politically partisan optic, which I think is part of the problem we have in this country, is you've got predominant number of Democrats and predominant number of Republicans, or at least allowed segments of both parties that have kind of drawn lines in the sand and said, here's what our position is. And I come at this as being a former Reagan Republican, where I had sentiments about the former Soviet Union that still reside in me today. And I look at what's going on with Russia and Ukraine, and as a student of history, I also feel like this is, history coming back and revisiting itself on us. So for me, it's very concerning, because I think that under the Biden administration, the words have not matched up with the actions. I mean, the words have been, however long it takes, when in reality, what we've given to Ukraine to defend itself has been too low in quantity. We've put too many restrictions on what we've given them. We've given them, for example, weapon systems and told them, okay, you're not allowed to strike in Russia. And we've given them weapons in inadequate numbers. I mean, we've given them th 31 Abrams tanks, which is, it's good that we gave them 31 Abrams tanks. We should have given them 3,000 Abrams tanks. So I think that the messaging is the real problem, because here again, coming at this from a high level, from a strategic optic, how does this look to Russia? So from the Russian standpoint, look how I would interpret this if I was sitting in Moscow as a Russian. I would, as a Putinite, I would look at the United States and say they're divided, they're half-hearted at best, those who do support Ukraine, and all I've got to do is wait this out, and I can have my way. So what's concerning to me, what's especially concerning to me going into year three of this conflict, is how our behavior in the United States looks to the Russians. Because whatever our intents may be, whatever whatever we're trying to message the Russians, and I'll get to messaging a little bit later, whatever it is we're trying to message the Russians, the message to them that they would interpret is, we're not united, we're not significantly enough supporting Ukraine, and that's really what they're going to pay attention to, is what we do, not what we say. So that's really what I have a hard time with. And also on the Republican side of things, I look at the different candidates and what they're saying, and with the exception of Nikki Haley, that's the only real Republican candidate I see coming out more fully in support of helping out Ukraine. Everyone else has been tepid at best, Trump in particular, and those around him, the MAGA Republicans, are concerning to me, because it seems like their focus is, not another dime for Ukraine. And it just, that sort of attitude, I think, reflects a misunderstanding of what we've actually spent in terms of giving to Ukraine directly, as opposed to putting into our own defense sectors to build and to manufacture the systems to replace what's been given to Ukraine. So it's a complex problem, but I think the core of the problem is how it looks from Moscow, and what messages they're taking from our behavior, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely. This is a this is a situation where every move and every failure, they will try to exploit, because that's their only game. They have very little. Half their army has been killed off. A lot of their good equipment has been destroyed. They are throwing in meat waves. They try to procure equipment and ammunition from parties such as North Korea, rely on, say, under-the-radar Chinese support, work with Iranian missiles and drones. As a consequence, and then they try to run a war economy, which is going to ruin them. However, at the same time, they think that they can run the table. They think, they believe that we are too weak to actually muster the resolve and the will. And we discussed it with General Ryan early on when we started our commemoration day at midnight Kiev time. We discussed exactly that, and he broke it down into that without the will amongst both elites and the population forcing the elites, without the political will, no strategy, and the strategy is not there. It seems evident that the administration as well as the Congress, and for different reasons, are quite happy to support Ukraine somewhat, but they don't really want Russia to be defeated, and they don't like to talk about in categories of victory, because if you want to score a win, if you want to destroy the evil empire or the evil or the axis of evil, then this is your opportunity, and a good one, and a cheap one by comparison, and a timely one also.
Right. And, you know, some of the commentators that I get on Twitter, if I post something in support of providing US aid to Ukraine, sometimes I get accused of being a warmonger. You know, oh, you're just, you know, neoconservative, and you're just a former military, and you're a warmonger. And you know, what I try to tell people is to say, look, you've got two choices here, really. And from my perspective, two choices only, given the nature of the threat from, you know, Putin's Russia. And that is, we can either support Ukraine and to sufficiently, right, so that the Ukrainians can successfully regain their 1991 borders and then join NATO. That's sort of the 1-2 punch. So support Ukraine so they can do that, which costs us less than 5% of our defense budget, which involves no U.S. Direct casualties of U.S. military personnel. And we don't have to go to war with Russia to accomplish this, right? That's choice number one. Choice number two, okay, is we let the Russians do what they're going to do, succeed in Ukraine, and they're not going to stop in Ukraine. And if anybody who's studied history, you know, for more than 15 minutes knows that autocrats who are in a position like Vladimir Putin is, don't sit back and say, you know, I've taken over enough territory, I've harassed enough neighbors, I'm going to stop here. That's never happened in history, not once. So I think that we're foolish, and, you know, to think that, you know, we're somehow warmongers if we want to support Ukraine. And oh, by the way, it's just simply, it's the moral, it's the right thing to do. It's how we've defined ourselves as Americans for over 250 years, right? Trying to support the aggrieved party that, you know, was invaded by a neighbor for no justifiable reason. And not only invaded, but, you know, being subjected to war crimes and listening to Putin and his, you know, barking lapdogs in the media and his senior folks talking in terms of genocide. I mean, this is kind of black and white. It's not really much room for discussion from where I sit. But again, the notion that supporting Ukraine equals wasting money is absurd, and the notion that supporting Ukraine equals warmongering is also, I think, indefensible. I think the opposite is true. We're actually avoiding the risk of an expansion if we support Ukraine today and do it correctly.
This is the interesting thing. It's the complete inversion of the truth. It's the inversion of the underlying facts as we know them. It's the inversion of the strategies which have protected maritime democracies over decades, if not 100 years, what we see at the moment as a narrative in the media. Where does this... And it's not limited to the Biden administration or some Republicans in their isolationism, but where does this meekness, this fear, this risk averseness come from and stem from? We're both old Cold Warriors. I don't remember hearing this from the likes of Storm and Norman and the people who were then at the helm?
No. Well, so in answer to your question of where does it come from, I don't know where it comes from, but I know what's contributing significantly to it, and that's Russian disinformation. And, you know, this is sort of my area of focus. I'm actually in the process of finishing up a book on this. And just by way of background, you know, I was a human intelligence officer for 30 years. And, you know, I'm married to a Russian. We've adopted a daughter from Ukraine. I speak Russian, I've been to Russia. I have a lot of, you know, Russian friends, both inside and outside the country. And the thing is, I mean, it doesn't make me an expert by any stretch. I acknowledge that. But the thing is, I've been watching Vladimir Putin since, you know, he first popped up on the radar screen in the West, because, you know, he's been in power for 24 years. And that gives you a pretty good understanding of what the measure of a person is as a leader if they're in power for that long. So you've got the combination of Putin having been around, and for us to be able to kind of assess him for literally a generation, coupled with the fact that look at where he comes from, right? He's a former KGB officer. He was in the KGB back when the KGB, every KGB officer was required to spend 25% of his time coming up with stories for disinformation. Now, think about that for a minute. We think about the KGB, and if you had to, you know, if you did a focus group and you sat down 10 experts and said, all right, give me the top three things. When you hear the word KGB, what are the top three things or top three activities you think of? And I'll be willing to bet disinformation won't be one of the things they come up with. It won't be, because you think about espionage, you think about, you know, active measures, different types of active measures, right? But we don't pay enough attention to the fact that disinformation has been literally part of their bread and butter in the Soviet Union since the 1920s. Okay. The former Soviet Union was the world leader in disinformation, right? And Russia has inherited that mantle, and not only inherited the mantle, but they've got a leader who they've had a leader now who, number one, understands the power of the media. And oh, by the way, also understands the power of disinformation. Okay. So in terms of where these attitudes in the United States come from, that is a good question. I can't give you a solid answer. We could talk for the rest of the day about that. But I can tell you that the Russians are making a concerted effort to influence how the American electorate and how key, you know, target segments of the population feel about the conflict because of the nature of disinformation.
The disinformation today in today's world is then used to exploit what has already developed. Because if you go back to Mr. Yuri Bezmenov, you will find out that he said that the KGB would try, as its most effective tool, try to undermine the culture, the resilience of the Americans, the fiber of their culture. And this is the only line of attack they had, which they believe that they could be successful at. It seems they have done part of that.
Yes. And here's the thing. There's a couple of data points I'd like to mention about disinformation that I think will bring some clarity to what we're talking about. And first of all, is the overriding objective of disinformation is not necessarily to make you believe a lie, right? It's to make you believe nobody. And that's the thing that we have to bear in mind, that what they're trying to do is erode our confidence in political institutions, our belief in political leaders, our confidence in the news media. They want to erode that. Okay. All right. So that's number one, first and foremost, I think the most important point about disinformation. Another point is that the Russians have gotten much better in terms of identifying. It's almost like acupuncture, right? You have to know where to put the pins in for it to work. And they've done a very thorough, competent, capable job of identifying what the target audiences are that they're going after, what the target audiences already believe, and then how to provide lies that, even though they're untrue, they're lies that somehow resonate with those target audiences. In other words, if I hear a lie that's perpetrated or disseminated on social media, and I already believe along the lines of what that lie is, I may look at that and say, oh yeah, see, this is just what I was saying, and I forward it to my friends, right? because that lie is consistent with my existing beliefs. And we've seen this in the sort of maturity of Russian attempts to influence our elections in 2016 and again in 2020, you know, in elections since then. They've gotten more proficient at identifying who it is they want to influence, what those folks already believe, and then how to reach out, especially through social media and through, you know, useful idiots in the mainstream media, and reinforce with lies, right, what those folks already believe. So I think that this is what we have to look at. And the third point I want to make about disinformation, okay, the first point again, that it's not to make you necessarily believe a lie, but to get you to believe nobody, right? The second point being that they are very effective at targeting selected segments of our population, right? Influential people in our population. You know, and the third point is that this is a major strategic weapon. Okay, this is a major strategic weapon. I think disinformation has got more utility and more value and more capability for the Russians in this conflict, in this context, than even nuclear weapons. Because I think nuclear weapons are non-players, because, you know, they could talk all they want, and Medvedev gets out and he rants, and, oh, well, you know, if we get pushed back to our 91 borders, you know, we can use nuclear weapons on Western cat, you know, okay, whatever, right? It's all blah, blah, blah. The bottom line is that any rational, sane Russian knows that, you know, if they go up against NATO, United States and NATO, with nuclear weapons, Russia is going to cease to exist too. It's a suicidal strategy. So I think that disinformation is relatively low cost, okay, compared to major weapon systems, certainly compared to a nuclear war, but in terms of its impact, it's pretty capable. And we're seeing a lot of it, and increasing reliance on it, for the reasons that other speakers have mentioned. So, you know, if you think about the losses that the Russians have incurred in the first 6 months of the conflict, you know, the cream of the crop, their airborne, their armored units, right? They're experienced, they're trained, they're competent, they're capable soldiers. Those guys are ancient history. They're worm food, right? They're gone. They don't longer exist. And all you've got now is conscripts predominantly from the outlying republics, right? Non-Russians, okay, for the most part, that are coming from impoverished regions, given a rifle, and horrifically abused, by the way, at the front, which is another topic, but, you know, being thrown in waves against the Ukrainians. So, you know, disinformation serves a lot of functions, not only in terms of influencing the West, but also domestically. Okay, these propaganda stories that are directed against the Russian people, that's also a component of it.
And the effectiveness can be seen also in delays incurred in political processes, in risk averseness on behalf of Western leaders. It's a direct consequence of an electorate befuddled and elites misguided and gullible media sources driving them up the wall. When you look at the current state of information, President Zelensky gave an interview to Brett Baier, directly calibrated and targeted to what can only be described as a predominantly Republican audience leaning towards the views of the, well, MAGA core. Brett Baier is a decent interviewer. I mean, no question about that. But this was Fox News, as opposed to the Tucker Carlson Putin interview. People at CPAC have been saying that they felt well informed, that they now had the right end of the story, that finally they heard something about Putin, because nobody says something about Putin. We all know what Putin says and does, but Tucker Carlson presents it in a different light. Brett Baier's interview with Zelensky, on the contrary, how do you see that? Does that have an impact? Does it have value?
Well, I think it has value, but I think, you know, it's interesting. You look in the aftermath of the Tucker Carlson interview, and one of the things that I noticed, and this is not doesn't really deviate from kind of the way social media works, is that people took from, first of all, the fact of the interview, right? There was couple things, the fact of the interview and then the content of the interview. So I think in looking at the social media commentary, people took away from that what they wanted to, People, and this is human nature. This is part of, you know, who we are and how we function as people. People heard what they want to hear. So I think this was kind of, it was disappointing, but not surprising, you know. And honestly, I think that for me, the Tucker Carlson interview, you know, and I put quotation marks around interview because he didn't really ask him any hardball questions. He didn't challenge him on things. For example, when Putin went up to his, you know, warped diatribe on history of Russia and Ukraine, you know, it's not like Tucker Carlson was knowledgeable enough to call him on any of the things that were seriously questionable, right? So, you know, the interview itself, you know, it has less importance to me, right, than what Americans already believe about the nature of the war, the nature of the conflict with Russia, because, you know, Russia has been thumbing us in the eye for literally a quarter century now. This is not a new development. It's something that has gotten worse and worse over time. It's almost like you've probably seen these memes on social media, the frog in the blender, right? This is like the frog in the blender, where it's like, you know, you're on low speed and it's like, okay, something's happening here, but I can live with it. And then the speed increases until the frog disappears. And that's kind of the way I think our dynamic of our relations with Russia have gone, where it's now, if you told me this 25 years ago that we would be in this state, I would have been appalled, right? But the problem is the American people have just had a very, very modest uptick, right, in severity over that period of time, to the point where it's hardly even noticeable to the average American. You know, oh, just another one of those overseas foreign problems. No, it's not. No, it's not. So I look at the Tucker Carlson interview in that context. You know, and Brett Baer, I'm glad that Brett Baer did interview Zelensky. But here's an important point. This has been kind of gnawing at me, to be honest, and it's been bothering me for the past 2 years, and that is this. We in the West have desperately needed a Winston Churchill, okay? Think about Winston Churchill in 1940. You know, he gave about four or five speeches to the British, right? And I think this is a useful historical analog, because if you look at the state of the United Kingdom in the wake of the Dunkirk evacuation, right? So yeah, they got most of the British army out, okay? But they left their equipment behind, right? So they got the soldiers out. So basically their army returns back home without their heavy equipment. And now they're facing the prospect of a German invasion. And there were voices in the United Kingdom at the time saying, you know what, let's throw in the towel. Let's negotiate a settlement with Hitler, right? And then Winston Churchill stepped forward. He became the leader, and he made a number of speeches that really turned things around. So looking at the present situation in Ukraine, we haven't had a Winston Churchill-like figure stand up and give a speech in the United States saying, here's why we need to support Ukraine. Here's what's at stake. Here's what happens if Russia is able to achieve its objectives. Here's what it'll cost us. Whatever it costs us, it's worth it. And I think that this has been long overdue. And it hasn't happened in the past 2 years. You know, it just, part of it is, you know, I suspect Biden's limitations as a speaker, you know, because of his advanced age and all, that may be the part of the explanation. But I think that somebody with some gravitas needed to step up and say, here's what we need to do. Here's why we need to do it. And we need to lead from the front and not from the rear.
That is what the bully pulpit typically is for, isn't it?
Yeah. And the thing is, that's kind of what role the United States has played in NATO. I mean, think about it. We've been a leader of NATO for, you know, since 1949. Okay. We've been doing this for a while. And the other thing too is, you know, NATO, the only country that would ever invoke Article 5 was us after 9/11. I mean, we had, you know, Norwegian F-16s flying over Washington, D.C. We had AWACS aircraft out of Luxembourg flying over the middle of the United States doing aerial surveillance. You know, we invoked Article 5. And these are things, when I tell this to the average person with a layman level understanding, they're like, oh, I didn't know that. Well, no, you didn't know that because no political leader ever stood up and said, hey, you know, we as NATO, it's been one team, one fight, and that NATO's been there for us. They have. Now, okay, it's a legitimate complaint that not all NATO countries, you know, 31 NATO countries today, right? Not all of them have contributed their agreed upon 2% to GDP, and they've kind of shortchanged the pot for a number of years. And, you know, that's the reason for a lot of militaries being substandard today. I get that. I totally get that. But these are conversations that should be happening behind closed doors and not in the public, the way the Trump administration, committee has been, and Trump himself, right, has been doing very much in public. I think, and there again, that goes back to messaging, because, you know, Putin sees that, and, you know, he's gleeful when he sees Trump making negative comments about NATO publicly, right, at these mass gatherings, these campaign rallies, right? These are conversations that definitely need to happen, but they should not be happening in public and not in the way that they are.
Absolutely. And I feel like I'm in a parallel universe. As you said, if you would have told me this 25 years ago, I wouldn't have believed it. Sometimes I think that, where are the United States that I knew? Where are these people, these, you know, straight-talking, tough, well-organized, ever-ready people who we were serving with, who we were working with, who I got to know? And I even worked for them later on in private business. And they do exist, yes, but there are much fewer of them. Some of them are not in positions of power at this time at all. It's very strange. It is. There is a cultural estrangement happening in the transatlantic alliance, and that is worrisome.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. And, you know, it's interesting because, and this is not necessarily a new development. I mean, I remember, you know, 20 years ago, okay, I was in Afghanistan, and I wasn't based at ISAF headquarters in Kabul, but I spent a lot of time down there, and I spent a lot of time with the Germans, the Brits, other countries that were down there. Just a quick war story. The Germans had a special forces contingent deployed to Afghanistan for a year. And I talked to their commander before they were about to withdraw, go back to Germany. And they'd gone out in missions, and they'd identified targets. And I asked him, I said, hey, how many firefights did you have? And again, they'd been there. They'd been out in the field for a year. He said, none. I said, none. He said, yeah. He says, because anytime we report something, it had to get reported back to ISAF headquarters in Kabul. Kabul had to call Berlin. Then there's the time difference. And then you had to get a hold of somebody. You had to wait for a decision. By the time we get an answer back, you know, whatever we had observed and whatever, you know, forces that we could have engaged with, they took off. So he says, we didn't have any firefights at all. And I think that this kind of story is emblematic of the kind of problems that we have within NATO. But these are, again, these are conversations that should happen. They should, you know, we should have discussions about these things, but behind closed doors with the appropriate responsible parties and with the focus on, let's figure out how to fix this rather than pointing fingers at each other and, you know, behaving like monkeys throwing excrement at one another in a zoo. I mean, I don't see any benefit to doing that. And again, all this does is it gives a wrong message, right, to the Russians, which we don't need to be doing.
Interestingly enough that you highlighted the German example from those years, and I remember as well that the colleagues who stayed on reported that what was once typically German, what we call Auftragstaktik, in combination with Innere Führung, so to say, the precursor or the part and parcel of how mission command evolved in the U.S. forces as well. But Auftragstaktik, right, which was always giving a framework for the commander on site to take care of his troops, take care of the mission, define tasks, allocate them, and pursue them to achieve the targets, respectively, make sure that if the targets could not be achieved, that a better or tolerable position would be achieved thereafter. All of this had gone out of the drain and was handed over to political micromanagement, something which, by the way, we've heard from our American friends as well, that some lawyers were telling them, no, you can't shoot that person, and you can't do this, and you can't make that strike.
Right, right. Well, this is not a uniquely German problem at all, and I agree with you. And I think part of the problem is it's an outgrowth, in the West at least, in the West, it's an outgrowth of technological capabilities, where now you can reach down to literally, you know, the platoon level from the Capitol, right? You've got the ability to communicate. You've got the ability to pull in information from different sources, imagery, humans, SIGINT, send it back, you know, to the nation's capital and have people look at it and make decisions. So, I mean, I think this is an unfortunate tendency. But along the same lines, here's another thing that's really fascinating to me is Ukraine in recent days knocking down some of these Soviet-era Russian AWACS aircraft, because what those are used for is literally command and control. Right, because the Russian military, in contrast to, as you said, the Germans and Aufklärungs Taktik and, you know, Innenführung and all that, you know, where you're basically decentralizing command, right? You're pushing command down to the lower levels. The Russian army is the opposite, right? They want to make the decisions as far back as possible, and these AWACS aircraft using them not so much for aerial surveillance against the Ukrainian Air Force, but using it for command and control of their own troops. So I think if the Ukrainians can continue knocking these things down, and I think the Russians have a pretty limited number, I want to say either half a dozen or maybe eight of them in their inventory, and God knows how many of them are even mission capable. And oh, by the way, you need the crews inside those aircraft, right? So every time the Russians lose one, that's a massive loss, because what are they losing? They're losing their ability to command and control the predominantly conscript army that they now have. So I think that this is really a strategic weakness. I'm hoping that this the uptick in losses of these aircraft is reflective of a Ukrainian strategy saying, hey, let's take these aircraft out of the picture. Let's reduce the ability of the Kremlin to be able to command and control forces in the field. You know, so that to me is a kind of a heartening recent development in the conflict.
Interestingly enough, and I agree with you on the AWACS side, because it has cutting down the very few AWACS capabilities which the Russians still have left by comparison to what we could muster and could bring to bear, even as a sort of say partnership help to Ukraine. It has a disproportionate impact on their mode of operations by that means. Whereas on the other hand, and that was General McRyan, when he highlighted this together with Clinton Hinault, who wrote an article about the use of uncrewed systems, and that there's a possibility to move one step further away from what we just discussed here. As you said, you put the finger in the wound, that the technological evolution had allowed essentially division command and far beyond that, even central command, if not outright the DOD, to take a decision. There's the famous imagery of President Obama overlooking a strike by the SEALs. And this now, there's a countermanding force, because the mesh setup sensor arrays of both civilian and military sensors available in the battlefield in Ukraine, on the one hand, the use of drones for both reconnoiter or reconnaissance on the one hand, as well as strike capability with the FPV drones, and the fact that these drones are now given and monitored and operated by the troops in the field, you essentially have again mission command with a lot of the key information. That it seems that now actually the battalion, the company, the platoon will have actually that kind of information to make decisions, as one would normally have said 15 years ago, division would have. This is different, and that's very interesting. If it's done well, General Ryan believes, this could democratize the army significantly more. It actually requires to have very educated people, people educated with the same kind of concept, Auftragstaktik and innere Führung, meaning that right. That you respect the individual in its intellectual capacity, its dignity, its person, which is so different from everything Russia stands for. But the Ukrainian army, when it has learned this and is learning this and is already applying part of it, may actually win that part of the adaptation game, because Russia may not be able to adapt to exactly that.
That's an excellent point. And, you know, I'm sure you're aware of this and probably most of our listeners, but, you know, if you look back at when Russia first annexed Crimea and went into Donbas. Look at the Ukrainian military in 2014 and look at where they are today. It's light years difference, right? The Ukrainians, and in part it's out of necessity because, you know, when you're the country that's being invaded and you're being invaded by a power that's flat out said that they want to eradicate you, okay, that gives you a lot of motivation to adapt, right? So I understand that part of the reason for the motivation has been necessity. But on the other hand, they weren't, I mean, I remember regular units in the Ukrainian military, they had guys running around in flip-flops, you know, beach shoes, because they didn't have boots, because the corruption was so bad at the time. You know, again, 2014, the corruption was so bad for, you know, after in the early days of Ukraine, right, that everybody up the line took a cut of the defense money that was supposed to be spent on equipment and boots and training, right, and weapons. And everybody was reaching into the pot for the wrong reasons. Now, these folks are very capable, and they've got creativity and imagination that they bring to bear. They've got, I've seen cases where 15-year-old kids are flying drones, you know, supporting family members at the front. So I mean, they're taking what they have, right, as inadequate as it is. And they're in creatively and ingeniously applying those things in the battlefield. And this is something you're not necessarily seeing on the Russian side, in part because, first of all, the cream of the crop of the Russian military is gone, right? The conscripts that have been forced into battle in meat waves, they're not properly trained. They're not properly motivated. And that's not the, you know, when you have that kind of a dynamic, you're not going to get creativity and you're not going to get the sort of esprit de corps developing that you've had develop on the Ukrainian side. So I think, you know, this is a really critical point to when you look at the difference between the two sides. Yeah, the Russians have the numbers, right? And I mean, you need numbers if you're going to do meat wave attacks. But the bottom line is that the Ukrainians are a lot more skillful, and they've come a very, very long way since 2014 in terms of their capabilities on the battlefield.
Sorry, I apologize. One sec. I got the call in the wrong pipe. I apologize. No, I'm so sorry, Fred.
Oh, no problem.
All righty. We've been on for a little while, and it seemed my voice was getting hoarse, and I thought I could fight this off with coffee. What a silly idea. I mean, man never learns. Now, having said this, if you take this all together, I asked the question beforehand, and we had it in with Rear Admiral Chris Perry, who said yes, it's possible. Now the question is, do you think that the Czech Republic's approach of finding close to whether it is 600,000 or 800,000 doesn't really even matter at the moment? The Czech Republic's approach of procurement in the open market, going to South Korea, going to various African countries, identifying vast amounts of ammunition, and then buying them up together with other nations, currently rumored to be Norway, indicated by Canada, Netherlands, as well as Denmark, maybe, and hopefully others. Could that tide Ukraine over to a point in time when American deliveries might be either coming back up as to ammunition? Alternatively, Europeans may have scaled up their capabilities and can produce more on a regular basis, because currently anywhere between 6,000 and 8,000 shells are rumored to be used on a normal day, which we haven't had for quite some time in Ukraine because they have had shortages, so they had to triage. But do you think that it is enough? Is that enough effort, or should we just simply actually empty the storages, go out to the open market, and be significantly more aggressive? Is there a chance that Ukraine can tide this over? Is the question.
Well, I think what the Czechs are doing, and you know, given who they have as a president, it's understandable. I think that what the Czechs are doing is good, but I think it's a Band-Aid. Unfortunately, it's a necessary Band-Aid, because until we in the United States get our act together and can get a significant flow of ammunition and weapon systems going again, until that day comes, you got to do something. I mean, the challenges, especially with the fall of Avdiivka, and you've got Avdiivka that has just fallen, and you've got the continuing meat wave attacks. You've got to have artillery shells, cluster bombs. You've got to have something to counter them. I mean, this is when it's most desperately needed. So do I think it's a good thing? Yeah, I mean, it's not optimal, but I mean, you do what you have to do. And again, I think it's a Band-Aid solution until the USAID gets restored. But I think the key point, though, is somebody in the U.S. government with sufficient gravitas has got to stand up and say, hey, look, you know, there was a time when we had a bipartisan approach to foreign policy. We did, all right, on major issues. And to basically rally the American people around that, because right now we're just too disunited, and there's too many partisan political issues that are obfuscating which should be a pretty clear picture, and that is that we need to be supporting Ukraine adequately. So the short answer to your question, yeah, I think it's a good thing. I think it's a necessary Band-Aid solution until we can get the flow turned back on again.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for that, Fred. It has been absolutely splendid. Thank you for joining us today on this anniversary and the commemorative event. I think it's absolutely vital that we keep the information flowing, that we fight the disinformation, that we bring facts and consideration and proper consideration to a wider audience, and we very much appreciate that you have committed to this. So we hope to have you back with us sooner rather than later, and we can hopefully follow up also in view of what happens in the United States in the coming weeks, because I think there will be a lot of to and fro meandering and political infighting, but we have to consider it. So thank you for your attendance today.
Thank you. My pleasure. Slava Ukraini.
Героям слава!